I would now like to recall the brutal suppression of his strike, during which 34 miners were killed by police gunfire. The events took place exactly 10 years ago at a platinum mine in Marikana, a town in South Africa 80 kilometers west of Pretoria. On August 10, 2012, 3,000 miners joined a wildcat strike demanding a 125% wage increase. A few weeks earlier, the British mining company Lonmin had negotiated higher wages with some miners without union involvement, and the remaining workers wanted to match their wages. The pro-government union NUM, whose former general secretary was Cyril Ramaphosa, who is now president of the Republic of South Africa, and the management at the platinum mine refused to listen to the workers' claims. So the miners rushed to their union office to submit their demands. There, NUM leaders, so leaders of the trade union, opened fire on the strikers, injuring two people. In the hours and days that followed, the situation continued to escalate and four miners were shot. Two policemen and two security guards were burned and killed with machetes. After these events, the workers continued to refuse to return to work and gathered with their families on a nearby hill. Four or five of the strikers carried firearms, hundreds more were unarmed. Meanwhile, the police had arrived with a contingent of 800 men and several tanks and helicopters. They surrounded the hill with barbed wire and opened fire on the crowd. A few minutes later, more strikers were shot dead on a nearby hill, at least 14 of them from behind or with their arms raised. On 16th of August, 34 miners were killed and 78 others injured. The following day, the police action was described by numerous media outlets as the Marikana Massacre. I spoke to Warren McGregor about this massacre of miners and its impact on society and trade union politics. Warren McGregor works as a program coordinator for the Global Labour University at University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. He is an anarcho-syndicalist activist with trade unions and also social movements in Africa. Warren, I'm very happy to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
So we heard the introduction about the events around the 16th of August 2012, now a decade ago. And my first question would be, you are involved in trade union education and workers' organizing. And in this violent conflict, two competing unions played a role. So the National Union of Mine Workers, NUM, and the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, AMCU. Can you tell us about these unions and why the hell the NUM leaders opened fire on its own members?
That speaks to the history of the development of trade unionism to an extent in post-democratic South Africa, or by that I mean since 1994, when there was the defeat of political apartheid and where the formerly oppressed black population, by that I mean black African, mixed race or colored, and Indian workers, achieved political freedom, at least. The National Union of Mine Workers, which was formed in 1983, interestingly, its first general secretary was Cyril Ramaphosa, who is the current president of South Africa, and who at the time of the Marikana massacre was an executive member of the Lonmin company that owned the mine. They had, since the early 90s, as an affiliate of the COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, had been and still is in a formal alliance with the South African Communist Party, with the ruling party, the African National Congress. For those of you who might not know, was the party of Nelson Mandela, which came to power in 1994 and which continues to be in power until this day. What had essentially happened over a long period of time and for a variety of reasons, which we can go into a bit later, a distance had been created between the NUM leadership and the workers that they were representing and were members of the union itself. In particular, this leadership came to be represented by the full-time shop stewards. Over time, these full-time shop stewards that were given in certain circumstances, particular positions in management, or if not positions in management, spend most of their time engaging with management. This led to quite a lot of distance between the NUM shop stewards and the workers themselves, and essentially were acting as a buffer between management and the majority of the workers who were in the union. So much so that a few days before the massacre, there had been a buildup of tension for a number of years between the rank and file workers and their leadership. So much so that in an ongoing dispute with management for higher wages and better working conditions, the workers felt that the shop stewards were not representing their best interests, and had led a march to the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers Shop Stewards office, and an office that essentially represented the union leadership at the mine. These workers were then fired on, as your introduction stated, which also in some way represents some of the key problems with trade unionism in South Africa, or at least in the more longer standing and bigger trade unions in South Africa, had essentially come to the fore. I'm not sure if I answered your question correctly. Could you just repeat it?
Yes, I think so. So I was just asking like how this could be, because this was really shocking me when I read about the events, that the workers first walked to their trade union office, and their fire was opened and people were severely injured. So I think you answered the question. What I also like heard in your words, that you were stressing that the political apartheid ended. So some kind of apartheid goes on. And is this also connected to what one could call kind of a corruption, because the former general secretary of the NUM was then member of the board of the Lonmin, the owners of this mine. So what were you meaning by stressing that political apartheid ended?
As we all know, with the development of any colonial and post-colonial circumstance, particularly on the African continent, the historic conditions continue to plague most, if not all, post-colonial African societies, including South Africa. Now, South Africa's era of colonialism is essentially divided into two parts. You had original European direct colonialism, particularly under the Dutch, and then more formally under the British, particularly with the discovery of diamonds and gold in certain parts of Southern Africa from the 1860s onwards. And with that, you had the creation of essentially a super exploitative capitalist system here in South Africa, which was essentially based on the minerals and energy complex which we have here, which still continues to dominate the South African economic and also to a large extent policy framework. But a minerals and energy complex, particularly around mining, diamonds and gold, and then later platinum mining, which was based on the super exploitation of black people. So the second period of colonialism is usually referred to as, you know, a special kind of colonialism in South Africa, where despite the fact that South Africa, around about the same time that you had the same situation in Ireland, in Australia and Canada, the granting by the British of home rule, but home rule in South Africa was actually based on minority white rule. And this minority white rule, which also created a political system, you know, based on the segregation of, in particular, the working class. This era of segregation essentially is formalized in what then becomes apartheid. So although racial inequality and a racist political and economic system exists before the advent of apartheid in 1948 due to colonialism, it's essentially really formalized and entrenched in South African society from 1948 onwards. But this system, economically at least, is still there as the colonial era was. The initial colonial era was based on the super exploitation of black labor. So this is very important because although political freedom was won from, you know, in the early 90s and mid 90s, in that for the first time in South African history, you had the right to vote being available to all people in South Africa, to all citizens, to all South African citizens. And that technically your opportunities for life could no longer be officially and politically determined and relegated by your race. Obviously, the political and economic history of the country, which denied for the vast majority access to power and access to the free development of life, of their own lives, continued to play a role in the new South Africa, and continues to play a role in the new South Africa period. Importantly, because number one, the system of capitalism has been perpetuated, also in its particular form, neoliberal capitalism, which limits the role for the state in being able to redistribute surplus and redistribute profits. But also the fundamental nature of the South African economy hasn't really changed. The minerals and energy complex with mining at its center continues to be a key, if not the key, and central feature of South African capitalism, along with the developing financial sector. But this capitalist system continues to be based on the super exploitation of black people and the super exploitation of black workers in particular. Not only was the struggle at Marikana, the workers recognizing the tremendous profitability of platinum mining in South Africa, but so too their struggles, which went alongside the struggles of those in their community. Although obviously the wage that they were demanding and the wage demanded by the rock drill operators as a section of the mine workers was the key feature. The broader community that these workers came from, that they were living in the impoverished communities surrounding the platinum mines, were also key to not only supporting the mine workers, but have been key in the post-Marikana situation as well, as regards the focus of activists and as regards the focus of worker complaints and worker activism since then.
I think it was ANC who also allowed the headquarters of firms to move outside the country to Europe and the US, so to London, New York and Switzerland. And also the German super big company BASF is very closely connected to the Lonmin and makes, I think, 10% of its profits from buying the platinum and also reselling it again partly. So indeed. Yeah, you can really see that this relation is still very connected to the history of colonialism and apartheid.
You know, indeed, and much like the rest of post-colonial Africa, despite South Africa's semi-industrialized nature, which has provided it with a relatively more wealthy economy than many other African economies, the South African economy has over time become pretty much like any other African economy in that it is fundamentally what it exports are primary commodities. So, some decades ago, there was a new term created, the term of neocolonialism, in that ultimately during colonialism, the African territories, the African colonies were turned, their economies destroyed, their cultures destroyed, so as to turn those areas and those territories and those colonies into number one, primary commodity exporters, and to turn their population into producers of those primary commodities. Much like the rest of Africa, South Africa's economy, number one, has become extraordinarily neoliberalized, and much more than it should have, and much more than it was actually demanded of, it became very early on in the mid-90s a participant, a very keen participant under the ANC government and in its relationship with big South African monopoly capitalism. It became a very keen participant in this continually globalized economy. In so doing, it became convinced that the way forward for the South African economy and thus for social economic development was to participate as a commodity exporter. But the commodities that were being exported from South Africa and which continue to be exported from South Africa continue to be primary commodities, particularly linked to the mining sector. The financial controls on investments, particularly on international investments, were relaxed, which meant and which continues to mean that despite the fact that South Africa is not a poor country, it is a relatively wealthy economy. Much of the wealth which is created by the work of the majority black working class, or by the working class which is majority black, the vast amounts of these profits are not reinvested locally, and are essentially invested on hot markets, on the big stock exchanges around the world, which has meant that over time, as in other places in the world, you have this increasing gap between an extraordinarily wealthy elite. These elites, both in the state and in the private sector, have become extraordinarily more wealthy, to the detriment of development projects and more broader socioeconomic development, which has meant that the majority of the South African population continue to live in extraordinary poverty and are denied ultimately the very fruits of their labor, which is what the Marikana workers were campaigning for, just to get a little bit more of the surplus and the wealth that their labor was creating.
Yeah, I think this also partly explains why the reaction was so brutal and so violent, because the workers really challenged the state of the things and demanded, I think, 125% more wages and also some kind of social security. So after this Marikana massacre, there was an inquiry or a commission established. It's called the Falem Inquiry. To try to look through the events, what happened, where it was, but it was also criticized a lot. I would like to ask you about this Falem Inquiry, and also something I read, there was a doctrine or an act was used because the workers taking part in the strike were accused of murder, although they were mostly unarmed, because of a doctrine of common purpose previously used by the apartheid government. So maybe you can tell us something about this Falem Inquiry and commission, and also the legal issues which came up in this commission, and also something about this I would like to hear.
So just one more aspect on the background, which you touched on, was the brutality of the response. Just before the financial crisis, the global financial crisis of about 2007-2008, platinum and platinum mining in South Africa had been on a very steep upward trajectory, and the rates of profitability were extraordinarily high. It was then forecast at the time that platinum would become the most important mining or mined commodity, overtaking gold and diamonds in South Africa. But the impact of the global financial crisis meant that despite the fact that tremendous amounts of profits were being made, the rate of profitability was starting to decrease. But the workers were aware of the amount of wealth and the importance of their sector to the South African economy. And thus, mine workers have always had a sense of their historical place within this development of South African society, not just South Africa, but Southern African society. But the very brutal response and the nature of the response to workers before and after Marikana reflected not just the importance of mining, the continued importance of mining and platinum mining to the South African economy and to its elites in the state and private sector, but also as an attempt to stop the protests and the strike as quickly as possible, to the extent it got out of control, in that the Lonmin executive and the state, they could not control the workers as they initially had planned. And thus, aware of the workers' militancy, aware of their discipline, and aware of their ability to and desire to stick it out until their demands were met, the state felt and the Lonmin executive felt that the strike had to be broken up by any extent. At the time, and this is then important for the Fallon Commission later, because what the Fallon Commission and other independent research uncovers is the collusion between the Lonmin executive and the South African state. Particularly key players were the Lonmin executive at the time, including Cyril Ramaphosa, who at that time was not a leading member of the ANC, or at least not a key decision maker within the ANC, and was outside of the political realm or outside of politics in South Africa to a large extent. But because of his historic ties to the union, but also his historic ties to the ANC, the ruling party, he becomes a key interlocutor on behalf of Lonmin between the executive and the state. He then engages with, and other players engage with, the Minister of Police, as well as the Provincial Commissioner of Police. Now, I must be clear that the Minister of Police, Cyril Ramaphosa himself, and the Commissioners of Police, as well as the heads of the police that were involved in this collusion, and ultimately in what I would call a conspiracy against these workers, the majority of them were African, the majority of them were Black. And these are the ones who gave the final orders, ultimately. The use of live ammunition was not a spur-of-the-moment decision on the last day when the workers were killed. First of all, the police were corralled around and had been mobilized around the areas where the workers were protesting days before. The delivery of live ammunition to the police occurred days before the actual massacre took place, which must mean that the decision to use live ammunition was always on the cards, in particular for the state. Now, it can be successfully argued, I guess, that Cyril Ramaphosa was not the final decision maker on the use of live ammunition, but he was involved in those conversations and must take central blame alongside key government officials at the time, the Minister of Police, as well as that's in the actual state structure, in the political structure, and then the Commissioner of Police, the Provincial Commissioner of Police at the time. The results of the Farmer Commission have been thus: nobody in the state and the executive has been found guilty of anything. There have been no arrests that have been made of any police officials and government and state officials, nor Lonmin executives. And as you correctly said, the people who were actually held to justice, and I'm using this in inverted commas, were the actual protesting mine workers who, as you say, were charged for murder using the common purpose law, which is essentially ludicrous. The Fallon Commission ultimately, despite exposing or was able to expose a lot of this apparent collusion and a lot of the details around the massacre itself, both before and after, essentially, like previous South African commissions, has not been able to hold those ultimately responsible to account. And this is a sad indictment, not only of the commission itself, but of the South African political process.
I read also that some email communication between Cyril Ramaphosa and the police were leaked or which were given to the Falem inquiry, and you could really see how Ramaphosa already like frames the workers as criminals, and really like this class hatred which comes from his words. And and he's now president of the Republic of South Africa since some years. I forgot now when he started to do this. And he's now like a millionaire and an influential business man.
Indeed. And this is one of the sad stories about the South African democratic transition. I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa was the first general secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers, which was formed in 1983. Prior to that, he was a law student, but he used that to essentially organize workers on the mines, particularly in the north of South Africa. And that initiative was used to launch the National Union of Mine Workers in 1983. He was the general secretary for some years, and was also key in the trade union unification talks of the late 80s, which formalizes itself into the creation of the Congress of South African Trade Unions. So, particularly in the 80s, he had been a key figure and a key leader, not only in the struggle to organize workers, but also in the struggle against apartheid, using trade union organizations, which were at the forefront alongside community organizations of the struggle against apartheid. He then leads the trade union movement and becomes part of the ANC delegation that is negotiating the democratic transition with the apartheid state and capital at the time. But as soon as a new government is formed in 1994, he leaves and goes into the private sector, takes advantage of the new policies and laws around affirmative action, and then later on the black economic empowerment created by the ANC government, and uses that essentially to become a billionaire in South Africa. He was very famous as stating in the late 80s and the very early 90s that the future of South Africa, the future of the South African economy, must include the workers, to then a couple of decades later claiming that the workers, many of whom were organized in the trade union he helped to create, were now criminals for conducting very much the same actions as he would have encouraged workers and had organized workers to do back in the 1980s. Mm. So it's quite a sad state.
Indeed.
Now, another important thing about the Falem Commission is that what the Falem Commission also uncovers is that those in the state responsible for this are not just the Minister of Police, because what we have in South Africa, we have particular clusters of ministers and government officials. So there's a security cluster, which includes the police, which includes the Minister of Police and other key government officials. And this cluster essentially is responsible for creating and implementing security policy in South Africa, including police policy. So therefore, although the Minister of Police was the most visible participant in this collusion against the workers, there's a security cluster that must also take responsibility, which includes not just high-ranking members of that security cluster, but the president of South Africa at the time, Jacob Zuma.